Welcome to Indigenized Connections on Air, a podcast brought to you by the University of Minnesota Extension Center for Community Vitality in the area of leadership and civic engagement, and also by the Minnesota Indigenous Leadership Network, which explores the issues that impact tribal communities and leadership throughout Minnesota. I'm your host, Jason Schlender, and I'm the American Indian Leadership and Civic Engagement Educator. My guest is Minnesota Supreme Court Justice Ann McKaig. Justice McKaig is a White Earth descendant and was raised in Federal Dam on the Leech Lake Reservation by her parents. That instilled in her a strong work ethic and belief that anything is possible. Justice McKaig is also the first American Indian woman to serve on the court. So please welcome Justice Ann McKaig to the podcast.
Can you tell us a little bit about your leadership journey?
Sure. Well, it's been an interesting one. It certainly is one that I didn't expect. Growing up in Federal Dam, Minnesota, on the Leech Lake Reservation, population 106. I certainly did not have dreams that I was going to end up where I am today, but I knew that I wanted to be a lawyer because I wanted to be able to help people. I grew up watching my mom and dad both be helping members of the community. My mom worked in Indian education at our high school, and so she was a pretty popular person, I would say, amongst the Native youth in school, a lot of my friends. She was the person that I saw them. She was the helping person. I saw her, counseling kids, kids telling her, I think, a lot of secrets, a lot of problems. She never shared any of those. I just saw her as the person that people would want to go to. And I was very proud of that for her, for that. That was my mom. And then my dad was, he was the blue collar guy. He had a small garage in town. And my mom used to always say that if we had to rely on him for income, we'd never have any, because my dad was the guy who it's like, oh, somebody would bring him, some fish and he'd fix their car or they'd pay him later. And in fact, when my dad passed away, he was diabetic and he had lost both of his legs and passed away at age 61. But there were several people who came to the funeral and said, oh, I still owe your dad money. And, I'll make sure that I get it to your mom. And that's just sort of Federal Dam, which I love about Federal Dam. But I knew I wanted to go to college. And so I did leave and went to school at St. Catherine University. And I will say that I think for me, coming from a small town, being in an environment with all women, that it sort of infused that leadership ability and telling me that I could be a leader and that it was within me. And I think they sort of drew out my strengths as somebody who was a very passionate person and gave me self-confidence that I didn't necessarily have when I got there. So I think that helped set me on a good path, and then went to law school. Hated law school. Can't say that I liked it at all. Kept telling myself, it's a means to an end. It's a means to an end. Didn't feel like I had anything in common with a lot of the students who went to law school, but found some good friends there and ended up having a good time, and I made it through. And then, I got a job in the county attorney's office and started working on child welfare cases. And specifically, I got to work on Indian child welfare cases. And that for me was not only professionally gratifying, but personally, because I was able to, I think, learn so much more about myself and my family and my community in a way that was just different from where I grew up, because my dad was not a traditionalist. He taught us certainly some things, but it's sort of that that break, as we know, from the boarding schools, because my grandfather was fluent in Ojibwe, and he had a lot of the traditions, but he was sent away to the boarding schools when he was young. And I think as time progressed, the family just started losing some of those. So in doing child welfare, I was reconnected with some elders in the community who were extremely patient and really taught me a lot. And that was the first time that I think I started to feel like I could be a leader in some way, shape, or form, because I noticed that people would start to come to me and ask questions or have me come and speak at things. And, you know, you're kind of like, why do you want me? And it felt good. I mean, I liked it, but I didn't have necessarily a lot of support from a supervisor that I had at the time, who really thought I was not leadership material. I think she didn't appreciate my communication style, which is pretty direct. So then it was kind of like, well, where does that leave me? And then I had met Bob Blazer, Judge Robert Blazer, who was the first Native district court judge in the Twin Cities. And he became a mentor for me. And I think he then really was like, you can do this. There are things that you can do. You can become a district court judge, and our community needs you, and you have obligations. And so I'm going to help you. And it wasn't easy, because I wasn't sure that I wanted to be a judge. And, you know, I was a very passionate lawyer, and he would call me into chambers and he'd be like, you know, you're rolling your eyes in court. You can't do that. And, you know, you're throwing the pencil in court and you can't do that. And you only make an argument once, you don't make it twice. And I thought, gosh, I'm always in trouble. But he just spent a lot of time with me, and I think really tried to help me mature both professionally and personally. And so then he's the one who helped me decide to apply for the district court. And then when I got on the district court, I was put in a leadership role. And I was sort of shocked by that, but also honored by that. And it gave me an opportunity to, I think, to show what I thought I was capable of. And I think I might have surprised some people, because I think I did a pretty good job as a presiding judge. And then we had this opening on the Minnesota Supreme Court, which I had no intention of applying for. And again, my mentor, Judge Blazer, came to me and said there was the opening, and I thought he was going to apply. And he said, no, you are. And I thought, oh boy, because it's very different. You know, district court to the Supreme Court is just very different. And I certainly don't fit the mold for what people typically would think of as a Supreme Court justice. You know, I'm Minnesota born, bred, and educated, and I don't consider myself somebody who's extremely, you know, intelligent. I mean, I think I'm smart, but I think I have a different kind of smart. I think I'm common sense smart, people smart, street smart, but that's not necessarily the same as what might be required for that court. But he really pushed me and said, it's really not about you. It's about our people. And we have never had a seat at the table at this level, and we need one. And so you're going to do this. And so I did, and I got it. And it's a tremendous responsibility, because I'm the first in the entire United States, which, you know, is kind of unreal. So there it is.
What's fascinating, I think it's obviously, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of pressure, you know,
a lot of pressure
for being the, you know, the first American Indian female, you know, to sit on the bench. So that's, but at the same time, you know, I think the thing I appreciate is, you know, is hearing those common themes of either elders or elder mentors that push you, you know, people into those positions for the bigger picture of having, you know, a seat at the table, or, you know, an opportunity for American Indian voices to be heard. You know, so those are always, you know, very important. So obviously, you know, the country and the state, and actually the, you know, the world is dealing with this pandemic of COVID-19. You know, there's a lot of changes. Some, you know, when we think of changes, some things, it's just things that are just everyday things that you take for granted. So it's like, before we started our podcast, I had to run to get some coffee, and the governor from where I live in Wisconsin. So,
oh, you poor thing.
So it was so using and wearing a mask is not an habitual thing for me yet. So I find myself walking in and I'm like halfway there and I'm like, oh man, I forgot my mask, you know. And then some people will say, I can see the look on some people's faces. They'll kind of look at me like, well, that's right, you know, you don't, that's why we don't need it, you know, or, you know, some people that take that more conservative stance of it being a constitutional right or a violation of our constitutional rights and things like that. So it's taken some adjustment, but, you know, I definitely follow the rule. You know, I've got personal friends that have been impacted by COVID, so that I guess that's important. But anyway, in these challenging times, what is important for tribal leaders to keep in mind?
Wow, it's Minnesota has done, I think, quite well. And I think what Minnesota's tribal leaders have done is that they have really remained united, for one thing. So that there's power in that being united. We're fortunate here when you talk about the seat at the table. You know, the perfect example is that we have the lieutenant governor who is Native, and that, you know, she's the first lieutenant governor in the country. And so that has resulted in Native voices being heard, acknowledged, sort of represented and repeated. So for example, you'll hear our governor or our lieutenant governor talking about the state and how we are dealing with the pandemic. And when they're giving those updates, it's never just about the state. It will be the state and our tribal nations. And, you know, that's never happened before. And so I think it is an opportunity, and I think our tribal leaders recognize that, for there to be a much improved collaboration between the tribal nations and the state government about how to address this, because there, it is such a problem that nobody can do it alone. And particularly when you look at what's been happening across the country, really, you know, as Indian people, there's, you know, limited access to health care. We've got, you know, issues of poverty. We've got isolation. We've got, you know, technology issues. So even for doctors who are doing virtual appointments, well, not everybody's able to do that. I know that at my mom's place, I have to, you know, go stand on a certain part of outside, be able to have any sort of cell service, let alone broadband service. And so our tribal leaders have done a good job of keeping in mind that while they're issues might be different, there's also many issues that are the same. And so not remaining isolated as those tribal nations, but trying to collaborate with the state and using some of those resources to help Native communities on the reservations and also in urban areas, because there just are greater resources. When you look at, I know our governor mentioned something about Indian Health Services and the number of ICU beds and what was available in the state versus what's available through Indian Health Services. And it was like 11 ICU beds available in the entire state for Native people through Indian Health Services, compared to the hundreds of beds available, you know, in the state healthcare system. And it's an education opportunity. I am hearing more and more people are sort of starting to understand, at least some. I mean, obviously we have a long way to go, but I always think of us as this invisible people. And the more that it's talked about, it is an opportunity for us to sort of be like, hey, yeah, we're here. You know, we don't look like the photos from the boarding school era. We look very different, and we are in all different sorts of positions, including, you know, the lieutenant governor, including me on the Supreme Court. You know, many people would be like, oh, well, you don't look Native. And that's sort of a frustrating comment that I get often, because, you know, it's, I think people don't necessarily understand that that can be sort of feel like a personal attack. So for our tribal nations, I just want them to remember that this is, I think, a unique opportunity to collaborate. And I'm proud of what's been done thus far.
It's interesting that you mentioned like just looks, right? So, I mean, I think that's kind of touches our insecurities in some way.
Yeah.
So even like myself, you know, it's like I've always wanted to have like a long braid, but never been able to do that. So,
yep.
And I get the same question, right? You know, and with my siblings, you know, I'm the darkest one. So they say, well, you're dark, but how come you don't have, you know, you don't have long hair, you know, or, you know, and I'm like, and I just, it was like, that touches like, you know, just a real sensitive thing for me. Cause I'm like, I know I don't have long hair.
Right. I don't need to be reminded. Yeah. My youngest daughter is blonde hair and blue eyed. And my husband is Mexican, and she gets really mad because people not only don't believe that she's Native, but they don't believe that she's Mexican. And she's just, you know, she's like, what do I have to wear, a sign? You know, she just gets very frustrated because she does feel like it's people questioning who she is because she so strongly identifies. And I do think that we still have a lot of assumptions about what Indian people should look like.
The other thing I think is really interesting too is like, I find myself, you know, asking the question, like, you know, if you're asking me what you think I look like, what do you think you look like?
Right.
And what do you, you know, how do you carry yourself? And, you know, so if you think of yourself, well, I'm an American, or I'm Irish American, or I'm an Italian American, or whatever, you know, it's like, I wonder how they, you know, how they identify for themselves. So it's interesting. Interesting topic. So what kind of changes do you see coming for, you know, in your position with the Supreme Court during the COVID-19?
Well, some positive things. Let me start with the positive. And some of these that I hope will stick around, not just during COVID, which is that for certain parts of our state, particularly in the rural areas where there is access to broadband. Well, first of all, let me back up. One is, I think that the state's going to address the broadband issue. I think the legislature has a desire to do that. It's been sort of on the radar for quite some time, but I think that the pandemic will force that issue. And hopefully it will result in there being free, you know, access to broadband across our state, because it's going to be required for education and healthcare, et cetera. With that, then, I think allows people who have always had transportation issues. So like, for example, for the court system, we're noticing that people who can appear through their cell phones love it, because they don't have to drive to a courthouse, whether it's in the cities or whether it's in a rural area. In the cities, they don't have to pay for parking. They don't have to try to find parking. They don't have to deal with any of that. They don't have to go through security. They can just get on their phone and they have their court hearing. And I think for some people, that's sort of that buffer. It feels a little less intimidating because it's through that social media rather than an in-person appearance. So we have had a greater appearance percentage than no-shows, which tells us something, which is also interesting because I've heard that also from the medical field, that they have had a much better attendance for medical appointments, for therapy appointments, because people are just finding that easier and it doesn't have all of the additional barriers about, I don't have a car, I don't have any gas in my car, my car is not working, I don't have somebody who can take me, I can't take off all that time for work. So I do hope that we will consider that as we go forward, because not all types of court hearings in my field, in my opinion, need to be in person. Now, there certainly are some that do need to be in person, but who are the court hearings for? Well, it's for the people who are coming to court. And so I think that we need to be a little more thoughtful about that. So I think that that has been positive. In the child welfare world, it's been hard for parents who have not been able to have in-person visits. That's been very traumatic. I think people have tried to be very creative how to figure out how they can do that. I think there's been progress made. But on the other hand, it has also allowed for a lot more FaceTime, because now we're utilizing the ability to do FaceTime, which I don't know why we weren't doing that before. You know, parents were only getting 1 hour a week with their kids for visitation. When everybody's got a cell phone, we could have been doing these nightly check-ins, FaceTime with their kids, and we haven't been doing that. So now we are doing that. And so I hope that that will stick around. There has been some really good partnerships between private corporations and government to try to get technology to parts of the state that didn't have it, including tribal nations, because the tribes definitely were having issues with lack of technology and, of course, no financial resources to be able to get laptops and cell phones and to pay for internet for people who needed it. And there's a number of the big corporations in Minnesota, like Target and Best Buy, Comcast, I can't think of all of them, but that really stepped up and helped fund that. So that's a great partnership. And, you know, we should be thinking more about that as well. And that has allowed for areas of the state which had those financial challenges for the technology to be able to meet those for kids. You know, I do worry about education. I don't know how our schools are going to do it. I feel horrible for our schools. I feel horrible for our kids. You know, the last trimester, it was interesting because we were doing our hearings virtually. So I was in the bedroom doing them so that hopefully the dogs weren't barking. And, you know, the garage door wasn't opening and somebody wasn't flushing the toilet. And then my husband was doing his stuff virtually. My son came home from Morris and he was doing his college virtually. And then my daughter was doing high school virtually. And it was all very different experiences. And for some kids for school, not having that in-classroom instruction, it was extremely detrimental. You know, we know that the food issues, kids who relied on and families who relied on the schools for food, that was an issue. The schools, I think, stepped up and tried to still make that available. But the lack of assistance to help kids who need help for getting their schoolwork done, I ended up calling this young man. He's a sibling of another young woman that I try to help. And I said, you're failing, because I get all these reports on them. And he's like, yeah. And I said, well, you're going to fail eighth grade. And there's no reason for that. So I went and picked him up, made him come over, made him sit down, you know, get out your computer. He hadn't even logged on once the entire trimester. And we talked about why. And he's like, well, you know, so-and-so pays for the Wi-Fi in our house. And if they're mad at me, they don't give me the code. And there's really nobody there to help me. And nobody really cares if I'm on. And so I made him come for 2 weeks. And I mean, he's super smart. And just making him sit there, he passed. He got all of his stuff done. I mean, it required some prodding. But also he felt really good about that, because I said, you passed, you got all your teachers have responded. And he's like, oh my gosh, I can't believe it. He's like, I thought that was not going to happen. And so I think we need people to sort of step up and not, you know, and try to help those forgotten kids, because he couldn't have done it on his own. He wouldn't have done it on his own. And just for a myriad of reasons. And so I worry about those kids during the pandemic, because I do think that there's more than we know of them.
Right. And it's it's a sad situation when poverty drives you to, forces you to, you know, to be in situations that are not necessarily the best for your, for your, for your health. So if you, I mean, that's a common thing too, you know, with, you know, there's tribal schools, you know, in our areas that having a, having breakfast and lunch is sometimes is their right. only, is their only meal. And so, you know, they're kind of forced to, you know, forced to go to these, you know, forced to go to school, you know, and, but at the same time though, I think about like, how our school systems, not necessarily speaking so much from Minnesota, but just from my own personal perspective, is just that, you know, that the school districts are just not equipped preparing themselves or, you know, or providing that opportunity. So for the upcoming school year, I have two high school children. And my daughter's
God bless you.
And, you know, my daughter's going to be a senior this year. And I feel, and just like what you were saying, I feel bad that, you know, because, well, just being involved in your child's education, you share your own experiences. So we were just like, oh, can't wait for this to happen, you know, and those same experiences won't, are going to be different. You know, maybe they could be better, you know, who knows, but our traditional high school experience that, you know, that I had, that my brothers had, that my sisters had, is all, it will be different now because they're introducing a virtual component to where you go to school for 4 days and then you have one virtual day. But then you also have just this whole, you know, this whole looming pandemic and things kind of going on. So people, the way that people interact with one another, whether you're wearing a face mask, you know, at school the whole time is different, you know,
yep.
And just the way you enter, you know, the, just the social interaction between friends and, you know, and athletics, you know, it's a big thing for, you know, for families too. So that's all being changed and modified too. So, so with that, how has the recent social justice movements impacted your work?
Yeah, now that has been a significant challenge because we are, we have to remain neutral on our court because there is litigation. There will probably be more litigation because we're the place where it all happened. And I think sometimes that that's really difficult for the everyday citizen to understand. We have had a lot of questions about how other Supreme Courts around the country and other courts around the country have been making making statements, and why isn't the Minnesota Supreme Court putting out a statement? And we can't, because there's really nothing I think that we could say that would be meaningful, because it would have to be so. So, you know, sort of just washed of anything that it wouldn't have any substance to it, because we are going to be the place of litigation and because we are going to have to make decisions on these cases. And for some of us on the court, myself and Justice Hudson, who's African-American, and Justice Chudich, who is lesbian, we have talked about how our personal lives and our professional lives are sort of clashing at this moment, because we obviously, well, we all have opinions about it, but, you know, we have expectations from some of our communities that we should be out doing certain things. And I think in addition to our responsibilities for our job, and it's put a lot of pressure on specifically some of the members of the court who are from communities of color. And that has, that's been really hard to navigate. We had a group of law clerks who I thought were extremely thoughtful, and they wanted to know why as a court we weren't doing something. And we ended up having a really good conversation with them and listening to their concerns, their hopes, you know, what they think we can do in the future as a court to address some of the issues in our state. And then also some of us just shared some of our personal, you know, it's like, I'm getting a call from so-and-so and they're like, why aren't you, you know, we're going to go out and we're going to be meeting at this place. And why aren't you, you know, going to join us? And I'm like, I can't. And having to explain that over and over, and some people getting it and some people just being angry, thinking that I'm just choosing to not do it. And it's not for a legitimate reason. When it's like, well, no, then I would have to recuse and I wouldn't even be able to sit on the cases that are going to come to us through this litigation process. It's been really hard because, of course, I have feelings about it. I mean, it's invoked a lot of strong feelings for everyone. And, you know, I have 5 kids. They've all got different feelings about it. And I think that's one thing that people sort of think that everybody thinks the same about it. And it's like, no, people have very individual feelings and responses to what's happened. And we can't just assume that it's all the same. And it's interesting how, you know, even some of these issues where you'd think we would all be sort of, at least in the broader issues, having the same concerns, that it feels very politicized. And to me, that's just another tragedy because it's missed opportunities, I think.
Well, I appreciate your perspective. And that's, I think that's something that's, that many people will probably need to understand, because I think that's what they're all, a lot of people are, whether it's a pandemic or if it's just these social movements, it's like a lot of people kind of go to those ones that they seek for answers. Mm-hmm. Right. So they, you know, they look to people that are scholars or your, you know, people in the law, people that are, you know, either provide some type of, it could be just a, you know, a doctor of medicine, just to kind of help kind of gain some sense of understanding. So, I mean, I appreciate your perspective. And obviously it's you're there to protect the integrity of the court. And so it's, you know, it's a huge responsibility. And, you know, at the same time, you know, you obviously must be, I don't know if you have to create an alias or something. So you can
I mean, that's sometimes it feels that way, you know, you like to, it's very hard to get away. Cause I don't like to be Justice McKeg. I like to be Ann McKeg. And it's really hard because everyone who knows who you are is like, oh, Justice McKeg. And it's like, oh no, I'm Ann. Whether it's, it wasn't too long after I was appointed, I was at Goodwill. And this lady turns around and she did a double take. And then she goes, aren't you Justice McKeg? And I'm like, oh yeah. And she's like, you're at Goodwill. And I'm like, well, yes. I mean, and it's sort of like, you know, you sort of have to just not care. I mean, but at the same time, it's like, I'd like to be incognito more. And you try to get people to just call you by your first name, but it's hard because it sort of is a direct, it's sort of like an instantaneous cutoff from people treating you just as Anne. They now sort of put a little bit of a formal distance, as you will. And I know it's a sign of respect for a lot of people, but for me personally, that has been very hard because that's just not how I was raised.
When we think of what ways do you see tribes connecting through economic development during the COVID-19?
Yeah. Well, one is that they've been making these partnerships with the with private industries. Also, there has been, I think, a little more work on trying to help tribes or to assist tribes to become much more independent. It's not the right word because they're sovereign, but to not have to go through the state to access certain things. And a perfect example is child welfare, which has been making progress over the years, because in the past, everything had to be accessed through state and local. So through the either state government or through local counties. And as the tribes have been becoming, building their infrastructure and their tribal court systems, there's been a lot of work done where the tribes are accessing the federal dollars that helps build their child welfare systems and strengthen their tribal courts and strengthen their social services so that they can address the issues that they feel are important within the tribal community rather than the state or the county sort of dictating what gets paid for. And with that, of course, comes, I think, much more freedom and ability to live as a sovereign nation. And so that's been very exciting. We have 11 tribal courts and tribes in Minnesota, and they have all been really increasing the amount of work and cases that have been going through the tribal courts. And I think that's really exciting because it's just allowed for them to do cases in a different way than what states or counties may handle the child welfare cases.
I also think that just kind of reflecting on something you shared earlier too about just staying united.
Right.
You know, as these different situations come up, you know, the tribes that have been relying upon themselves, you know, really utilizing their self-sufficiency, you know, asserting their sovereignty in whatever capacity, but working together is, I think, is important. In my communications with other tribal leaders, they've, you know, really appreciated having that, the opportunity to be united front, working with the state, whether it's daily communication with the governor and the governor's cabinet and their different, you know, staff there. I think that's probably a sense of empowerment and, you know, and security, you know, can go a long way as far as providing resources to tribal communities as well.
Yeah, and it's just much more powerful. I think it just puts them in a much greater position for whether it's negotiating or whatever it may be, because if the 11 stick together, I know that the 11 tribal nations are, for example, they are on a phone call with the governor every Friday. And, you know, that hasn't happened in the past, and which is great, rather than the governor calling, you know, each individual one. They're a collective group. And what I really appreciate is that when I've been on some of those calls is nobody's willing to sort of step out and make a decision independent. They're like, well, we're going to talk and we'll get back to you. And for me, that's just so wise, because it just gives them so much more power.
So Justice McKeag, I appreciate your time. I just have one last question. I appreciate your story. A person like yourself provides a model for our Native communities that anything is possible. You know, your story is kind of reflective of something similar. You know, my father was an attorney. My brother is now. And so, you know, I'm familiar with that whole kind of, and I even tried to, I took the LSAT and, but I'm in education now. So I obviously, you know, didn't make it to those ranks as, you know, but, you know, any parting wisdom, you know, that you would like to share, you know, as we conclude our conversation here today?
Yeah, the only thing that I would say is just that anything is truly possible, and that you should never let people tell you no or close the door on you, that you should hold that power for yourself. And you alone should be the decision maker for what your path is and for where it goes. And if I would have listened to all of the no voices growing up, you know, it was the pat on the head, like, oh, that's cute that you want to be a lawyer. That's so sweet. That's just never going to happen. But look what she wants to do. And even as I progressed in my career, like, oh, she's not leadership material. You know, it feels really good when you get to where I am to be like, oh, well, how you like me now? I was the Toby Keith song, when that comes on, it's like, I love that song because it's very sweet. And I'm so, you know, I am proud of myself in that I stayed focused on wanting to at least be successful. And I think successful can look very differently. It's just being happy and liking what it is that you're doing. I don't think it means that you have to be in some, what people might consider, prestigious position. That's not what success means. But really believing in yourself and finding those around you who believe in you. I mean, I wouldn't be where I am without Judge Blazer and many others like him. And, you know, I know now that I have the obligation to help others achieve their dreams and their goals. And so we don't ever do it alone, but we have to start by believing in ourselves. So that's what we need to do, because we deserve to have a seat at the table, and that's at any table.
Well, miigwech for your time.
Oh, miigwech to you.